Good evening, and welcome to Local Motion. Tonight, we're going to hear about outdoor recreation. It's snowed heavily so far this year, and cross-country skiers, backcountry explorers, and snowshoers are happy. Skiers and adventurers of all types are hitting the snow, and while fun, it can also be dangerous. Tonight, we're going to start with Dave Knutson, the president of the Grand Mesa Nordic Council. He took a break from skiing to talk about the council and how this year's been.
We were formed 25 years ago, so this is our 25th season, and we kicked it off with a bunch of people like Winslow Robertson, Tom Ela, a few other people that are still board members with us, and they were groomers at Powderhorn, and Powderhorn quit doing cross-country skiing, so these guys moved the operations up to the Mesa and started grooming way back in, I guess that was 1991. So a lot of times, most of the time we started out just duct tape, paper clips, you know, hardly anything. And Grand Junction Lions Club stepped up and helped us purchase our first snowmobile. And that kicked us off as far as grooming. So we've been grooming up on top of Grand Mesa for all that time. Right now we have a Piston Bully 100 that's about a $150,000 grooming machine that has a cab and it's heated and everything. And we have about four snowmobiles and about three or four implements that drag behind them to groom the trails. We groom 55 kilometers of trails up on top of the Mesa, 34 miles. And we also groom Ward, which is a backcountry skiing area on the Delta County side. So it's pretty extensive. We have, let's see, two contract employees and four grooming hourly employees. So it's a pretty big operation. We spend about $80,000 a year grooming up there.
Wow.
Yeah.
It definitely seems, anyone looking outside the window will tell you it's probably a good year for cross-country skiing. What's your opinion? How's this year been so far?
This year has been great compared to most years. Typically in the fall up there, it gets kind of light during December and we don't get a lot of snow. But we dependably can ski before Thanksgiving every year. And so we're one of the few, probably the only Nordic ski area in the state that can start a season that early. And we groom all the way to the end of March. This year has just been fantastic. Actually, the groomers are having a little trouble keeping up with it.
Yeah, I was going to ask, is that a problem? I imagine, you know, grooming 34 miles, that's a huge task.
Yeah.
And when the snow has been coming down as fast and as consistent as it has, I imagine it's tough to keep up.
It is hard to keep up. In order to have, there's a couple different kinds of skiing that go on up there, skate skiing and also regular classic Nordic. The classic Nordic is the kind that's kind of the kick and glide. I think most people are used to seeing that. The skate skiing, if people have watched the Olympics, those 50-kilometer races and stuff, it looks like ice skating is what they're doing, but they're doing it on skis. For skate skiers, they need a really hard packed surface, and that's our big challenge, is to make that perfect corduroy 12-foot wide skate lane for the skate skiers. And we have to do several passes across each trail in order to get it packed down enough for those skaters.
Wow. Yeah. Catering to all the skiers, the skate skiers, the classic cross country. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people, it sounds like, up on the Mesa.
Yeah, if you typically go up on a weekend, especially a three-day weekend or the holiday seasons like right now, you'll see both our parking lots are packed. And especially between the hours of like 10:30 till about 2:30, 3 o'clock, it's sometimes hard to find a parking place.
Does that feel good as the president of the Nordic Council to see that?
Yeah, I'd like to see people carpool more, of course, because a lot of us are up there just, you know, one person in a car and we're taking up all this space. But the use is really incredible. Now, what's surprising is you'd think, oh, with all those people in the parking lot, it's really packed on the trails. You get out on the trails, that trail system is so huge, you'll run into a couple people, depending on what trail you're taking, but it doesn't feel crowded at all. It's really a pristine, almost wilderness type of skiing, and that's also what's unique about us, because most Nordic ski areas start out in towns, like in Crested Butte and Vail and places like that, and they're skiing among buildings, and it's very rare to be out and just skiing through forests and meadows like what we do.
How have you seen, because Nordic Council has been around for 25 years, has the interest in cross-country skiing waxed and waned?
You know, I have to credit previous board members with starting up some programs that have kept us strong over the years. people in the North Fork may know Richard Hippio and Anita Evans. They started out a program 11 years ago called Skis for Kids. And what they've been able to do is get grants and business support in order to buy equipment for kids. And so when we do gliders lessons during January, Anita and Richard bring up all the rental skis for the kids, and they sign them out for the entire month of lessons. They take them home with them. And so that kind of builds the horsepower for the future. And last year was the first year we went over 500 members. So it's not like it's waxing and waning. It's like it's continually increasing.
Wow. That's great.
Yeah, it's really neat.
I was curious also about avalanches. With the amount of snow we've been getting, there's a moderate danger of avalanches pretty much all around the western slope. Mm-hmm. Is that a problem that cross-country skiers run into?
Backcountry skiers run into that, but our cross-country skiers don't because our trails are generally on fairly flat terrain. The only trail that has any elevation gain is Ward, and that goes up 1,000 feet over about 5 kilometers. So it's kind of a gradual increase. There's no big steep slopes. So that's one of the things, the avalanche danger is not there. And what I'm seeing is some of the skiers that have been downhill skiers all their lives are getting up in years, and now they're taking up cross-country skiing because it's not so demanding, not so expensive, and it's easier on their bodies.
Yeah. Do you do any backcountry skiing yourself?
I just started to get back on this primitive pair of Norwegian wood skis I have that are wide enough to take in the backcountry. And I started skiing around the Ward Trail system because we groom like this swath through the middle, but there's all these little trails that cut off on either side. And it's just really fabulous skiing. I've really been enjoying it a lot, but I just started again this year. I used to be a snowboarder, and so I do backcountry snowboarding, doing snowboarding and snowshoeing.
I moved out here to Colorado. I've been cross-country skiing twice, I think, mm-hmm. and I enjoyed it. What about it hooked you?
Being born a Norwegian in Minnesota might have started it all off.
Genetically predisposed cross-country skiing.
Learning to ice skate when I was 3 years old, because that's basically 7 months of winter. I just really like the feel of gliding through snow, and I've been a marathon runner, and the exercise is what I really like, and so I get a lot better exercise with cross-country skiing than, say, downhill. I worked at downhill resorts and stuff through college, and I did a lot of downhill skiing and snowboarding, and I have nothing against that. I just like the physical exercise, and that's what I like about cross-country skiing.
Yeah.
Now, new people... we offer adult lessons and adult classes. As a matter of fact, we have a series of adult lessons that are just starting in January. And they cover all levels, from someone that's never been on skis to people that are intermediate and advanced. And we separate them by groups. And the ratio to our professional instructors to students is usually about 5 or 6 to 1. So it's really good. And you're grouped with people that are liked abilities, so there's not that intimidation factor. And then in February, there's a women's clinic that goes on during Fridays in February. So we have a lot of offerings for people that want to hop on cross-country skis and start out.
Wow. I've heard that the Grand Mesa is, it's the largest flat-top mountain in the world. Is that
correct?
Right?
Wow. Yeah. Yeah.
And I heard it also, that condition, being very high up and completely flat, mm-hmm. makes it like ideal cross-country skiing. Is that right?
Yeah, ideal cross-country skiing and ideal snowmobiling and snowshoeing. All those things go on. Now, we have a really good relationship with the snowmobilers. They have a corridor through the middle of our trail system that gets them toward this end of the mesa, and they groom that. But basically, we have a ski area boundary that the Forest Service has set out. We also allow snowshoeing around our trails, and that's part of what the Forest Service requires with us, that's multiple use. And so snowshoers can go up there. We just ask snowshoers to snowshoe in single file on the opposite side of the lane that the classic tracks are on, and just stay off to the side so they don't damage the skate lane and they don't damage the classic tracks.
Right, so they don't shred the tracks.
Yeah, they do a lot of damage.
Who pays for all this grooming? $80,000?
A lot of people have the misperception that somehow the Forest Service pays for this grooming, and they don't pay a dime. This is on Forest Service land, and we have permits for it. But the only way the trails up there are groomed is through member donations and through the grants we get. And that's part of our principle. Our principle is that we want to keep it free and open to the public. And we'd like people to just donate. It's one of the few areas in the state where you don't have to pay trail use fees.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, Dave, thank you very much for coming.
Yeah.
That was Dave Knutson, president of the Grand Mesa Nordic Council. For those seeking a more wild thrill, backcountry skiing can be the go-to sport for this time of the year. The snow may have stopped falling, but avalanche danger is still there. Ethan Green is with the Colorado Avalanche Information Center, a state agency set up to raise awareness and protect people from avalanches.
Well, the Colorado Avalanche Information Center is a program within the Department of Natural Resources. So we're a state government group. We're tasked with reducing the impact of avalanches on the people within Colorado and the economy of the state. Right now, it's kind of the intersection of kind of three different groups. So we're a program within DNR. We also work very closely with the Colorado Department of Transportation to do forecasting and avalanche safety program for the state and federal highways. And then we also work very closely with a nonprofit group called the Friends of the CAIC on a backcountry and a recreational program.
Could you tell me how this year has been so far? How the avalanche danger is shaping up?
Well, it changes a lot throughout the state, but and the area that you're talking about kind of covers maybe 3 to 4 of our forecast zones. We have 10 zones around the state covering, really all the mountainous areas. And so, where KVNF is in Paonia is, and the broadcast area you're talking about covers, basically 4 of those zones. You know, we started out with some snow in October and kind of early November, and then we had kind of a long dry period. And so that snow's kind of formed a weaker structure that's at the bottom of the snowpack, but it's not at the bottom of the snowpack everywhere. It's mostly kind of near and above tree line. And so we had some kind of elevated conditions sort of in early December, but otherwise it had been kind of a quiet year until the series of storms came in just before Christmas and kind of over Christmas, which put down just a huge amount of snow. And that just spiked the avalanche conditions. We went from, kind of what we'd call moderate avalanche danger to high danger and warnings just in about 2 days. And then we stayed there for maybe 5 days or something like that. And then so we had lots of big avalanches. There was tons of avalanches in the Crested Butte area, our Gunnison zone. We had some really big avalanches in the San Juans, very sensitive conditions where we were going out doing control work and, just dropping explosives on the slope before it actually would detonate could trigger some avalanches. We had a snow shed on Wolf Creek Pass over US 160 that was, we had an avalanche reach that shed, which it hasn't done since 1997. So it was a very active period. But then the snow stopped and the wind stopped blowing. And over the course of about another week, the avalanche conditions have dropped into this kind of middle of the road area, which is kind of a scary spot for backcountry recreationalists because we have some beautiful weather, clear skies, calm winds, and still some places where you can trigger a pretty dangerous avalanche. And so this is, we've kind of dropped from our level 3 out of 5, which would be a considerable avalanche danger, to now mostly level 2, moderate avalanche danger. And most of the fatal recreational accidents that we see happen at one of those two levels, kind of that middle part of the avalanche danger scale. And again, that's because it's typically pretty nice weather. You can travel a lot of places, but if you go to the wrong place, you can trigger a pretty dangerous avalanche.
How does that happen where the snow can sit there for weeks and it's still dangerous?
It's one of the features of the snowpack we have in Colorado. And really what happens is we end up forming these kind of structural weaknesses in the snowpack. The Colorado snowpack, any seasonal snow cover, forms layers. And that happens with every snowstorm, every windstorm, every calm period will kind of form a layer within the snowpack. And if you go up into the mountains and you carve down into the snow, you'll see these different layers similar to, say, looking at the rings of a tree in the wood. And so each one of those layers forms throughout the winter, and how those different layers interact will determine our future avalanche conditions. In Colorado, we have the climate that will form weak layers of snow that then get buried. And when we get big snow and windstorms, those weak layers start to break and produce avalanches. But then as that layered structure kind of adjusts to the new load of that what was put down in that big snowstorm, then it goes into this kind of conditionally unstable period where it's just kind of sitting there hanging out. It's doing just fine. But if a skier or a snowboarder, snowmobiler, or somebody crosses the slope and hits it just in the right spot, can produce a crack that just brings the whole slope down.
So the avalanche danger out here is, it's considerable. And every year there's, it seems like, a few deaths from avalanches. What are the biggest mistakes that people make when they're out in the backcountry?
The biggest mistake that I think people make is to kind of underestimate the danger of these natural hazard events. There's a lot of places you can go, and with a little bit of information and a little bit of knowledge, you can do a lot in the Colorado Mountains. And it's a beautiful place to recreate. We are really lucky to live in such a beautiful area. But you also can't underestimate the danger that's out there. And so what we recommend that people do are kind of three things. First is to get information on the current conditions, get the avalanche forecast. We put out these products every day, and they'll give you some idea of where the what the general avalanche danger is and kind of where the dangerous places are. The second is to get a little bit of information, a little bit of education, some knowledge, so that you can interpret those avalanche forecasts. If you're going to spend a lot of time in avalanche terrain, you probably want to go take a multi-day course where you're spending some time in the field and really spending, you know, 3-4 days with avalanche instructors. But if you're just going snowshoeing or trying to stay away from avalanche terrain, but still need to know a little bit about it, you could go to the National Avalanche Center's website, fsavalanche.org. You could go to an evening avalanche awareness talk. Just a little bit of education will help you interpret those avalanche forecasts. And then the last thing would be to carry proper rescue equipment. Again, this is most important if you're going to be spending a lot of time in avalanche terrain. Every person in your group needs to carry an avalanche rescue transceiver, a shovel, and a probe pole, and know how to use all three of those pieces of equipment. If you're in and around ski areas, reco tabs, which are little electronic reflectors that come in some of the clothing that you can purchase, are also a great way to kind of give yourself a little extra margin for safety so that somebody else can find you if you do get buried in an avalanche.
Well, there's a lot of things, but I realized when I asked that mistakes might be the wrong word. I imagine that avalanches can happen to people that are even prepared and aware of the danger.
Yes, absolutely. Being prepared and aware of the danger doesn't guarantee your safety. And really what we're talking about, especially when we're dealing with recreation, is risk tolerance. What are your goals for that recreational day? And how much risk are you willing to accept in order to achieve them? And that's something that's really different for every individual. And so that's why for us, what we really do at the Avalanche Information Center is try to provide good information so that people can make informed decisions about where they're going, what sort of risks they're willing to take, and how they're going to manage that risk while they're in the field.
That was Ethan Green with the Colorado Avalanche Information Center. The backcountry can be dangerous, but the pristine beauty and remoteness draw plenty of visitors and residents all year round. That can lead to stranded and injured people far away from help any time of the year. Phil Volkhausen is the president of West Elk Mountain Rescue.
It was started sometime in the 90s, and it was designed to be a search and rescue organization for the western side of Gunnison County, as it's difficult for the teams that come from Western State and Crested Butte to get over to this side, to Marble and to the Muddy Creek area and to Somerset in the winter or even in the summer. It's a long drive.
Yeah, I imagine the county line and jurisdictions don't always fall with whatever's easiest to get to.
In these mountainous areas, it's kind of interesting. Yeah, it's true. Yeah, so we're in Delta County, but we work for Gunnison County. Yeah.
the West Elk Mountain Rescue, what type of calls do you respond to?
We are called out by any time that the Sheriff's Department decides they might need a rescue service on this side. And we also respond to calls that Western State or Crested Butte might have if they don't have enough people. We also help the Black Canyon if there's a rescue on the North Rim that we come and assist.
So how often is West Elk Mountain Rescue called up for things like that?
Well, we have very few call-outs compared to Crested Butte and Western State, and I think it has to do with
That's great.
The population over here. Yeah, it's great, but it also is difficult for our group to keep interest when we don't have a lot of rescues. So we train every month, sometimes twice a month. That's what keeps us busy, but we only have usually 5 or 6 call-outs, actual call-outs a year, and I think we had just 4 this year. But the training keeps us going, and sometimes we need to be good, and it, you know, it may be 3 months or 4 months, there's nothing going on, and then 2 o'clock in the morning, you get notified that there's a problem, and you gather everybody and do it.
Yeah, and that call requires just as much effort and for your team to be, I imagine, be on point as if you had calls every week.
Yes, it is. And there was a few years ago, we did have a call out like 8 weeks in a row or twice a week, something like that. And people were getting cranky about it, but that's more normal for search and rescue groups. In fact, in Aspen, the Mountain Rescue Aspen responded last year, I think there were 200 call outs that they had, but only a couple of them were searches. And because everybody over there is out in the mountains and everybody has a cell phone, and it's very seldom that they actually look for somebody, but they know where people are. And we're just, these mountains aren't used as much here, and people stay on their ATVs for the most part. We don't have that many adventurous people out here, or the ones that are rescue themselves or are smarter or something. I don't know what it is, but we just don't get the volume of calls.
Does that mean that the calls that do happen on this side aren't the easy fixes?
It can be, because oftentimes there's a search and it's a vast area. 2 years ago, we participated in a search that was initiated by the Crested Butte Search and Rescue, and there was they felt that because of a phone call from a cell tower, a ping from a cell tower, that the person was on this side of Crested Butte of the Rubies. We didn't find her. In fact, nobody found her for a few months. There was a body was found a couple months later. And as we were out there looking, you can look up and realize that if the person isn't on a trail or right in the valley, that it's such a vast area that your chances of finding a non-responsive person are pretty small. So you need dogs, and you need, or super trackers, or you need something else. And it's amazing. Yeah, they can be very difficult in that. Once they're really out and lost and off the out of the valley floor or off the trails, it can be a real challenge.
Are most of the calls that you've been on lost hikers, lost skiers?
Yes, lost hikers, I'd say, is the majority. People always think it's going to be the hunting season. We did have one hunter that we helped rescue this year with in conjunction with Western State over near Kirikanti Creek, but most of them are lost hunters or lost hikers. We don't have much in the way of lost skiers. We prepare with a lot of training up on the Huntsman's Ridge area, which is actually part of Pitkin County's rescue system. But those of us that are skiers go up to there a lot, and we figure we ought to be ready to help one of our own or help a local person out or assist Aspen Mountain Rescue with a rescue there, because we would have to actually haul them uphill if they were hurt on the Huntsman's Ridge. So it would be a big challenge. We practice all the time to bring a sked, which is basically a piece of plastic that you wrap around the person and tie it up and would pull them out that way. And but we have not had a ski rescue in recent years of a skier or a snowshoer.
Why is that?
I think that the skiers and snowshoers take care of themselves pretty well. And other than that, it's just luck, dumb luck. There could any time be a rescue around here.
He says the backcountry skiers and snowshoers kind of rescue themselves. What do you mean by that?
Well, they have friends with them, and if someone has a sprained ankle or a broken leg, they probably would do their best to get the person out right away. For instance, in an avalanche situation, if you are part of a party that someone gets in an avalanche or your group gets in an avalanche, it's a known fact that you don't go for help because you are the help. If someone's in an avalanche, you've got a few minutes to maybe to save that person. Anybody that lasts longer than a couple of hours is a very small statistic. Most people that are buried in an avalanche are going to be dead in 15 minutes, probably they're not going to survive. So we or some other rescue group would be called out to search for the body. And at that point, you know, we try not to risk our own health, our own safety, looking for a dead person. And we would be very cautious also going into a situation where there were going to be more avalanches or whatever. We try to protect our team. It's not like, it's interesting because firefighters rush into a building and risk their lives. And the theory in search and rescue is that these people kind of got themselves into this situation and that we don't want to have more injured or dead people going to get them out. We want to go and minimize the risk and help them and get them out. But we don't want to expose ourselves to another avalanche trying to get somebody out during a storm when it's snowing an inch an hour.
I imagine it's difficult, though, to, you know, you mentioned finding someone months later. A lot of the searches end, I imagine, rather grim.
It's hard to say. I'd say most of our call-outs end before we actually get out of our trucks. We're called off or told to stand down before we actually go search. That people are notified, we get ready to go out, and then the person shows up. I'd say that's the majority. The second amount is it's amazing how we actually find people sometimes. It is so lucky. Some of it's luck, and it works out well. We had a nice rescue for a hunter this fall in our group. We teamed up with Western State, and one of our people actually found the guy. And it was great. You know, sometimes it works out well. There was a rescue a few years ago where a guy had fallen on Snowmass Mountain and was badly injured. And we had some assistance finding him and stayed with him. And we needed some equipment that Western State came in and assisted. And it was a really good rescue. The guy was flown out by helicopter and just in the nick of time, he just barely survived. So there are instances where it really works out well. And there are instances where it's a body recovery, and it's somewhat grim, yeah. And that's how it works. And hopefully that you do well and you're able to find somebody. Sometimes you don't, and that's just you look back and you try to say, what could we have done different? What should we have done different? We always look, and we don't know. You know, it's a difficult deal. And if we were doing it all the time, we might know better. But I think the statistics in Summit County in Aspen, where they have call out, there are people that just don't make it. You know, they're out there injured or they're dead, or they have a heart attack, and that's it, done.
The people that do get lost, that do have call outs that you respond to,
yeah,
what went wrong with their day that ended up having to have search and rescue come and find them? Usually.
Usually it's bad decision-making, inexperience. For instance, the woman who died a couple of years ago was a trail runner, not dressed well enough to be out in the wilderness, made a wrong turn, which happens. I mean, it happens to me sometimes in the fall. I get lost, and I don't tell anybody because I'm the president of Mountain Rescue, and I don't want people to, you know, it'd be such a good story that nobody could let it go. So I find myself, you know, but people make bad decisions. And she didn't have enough clothing to survive, and she went out and then got off the trail and left her pack somewhere, probably tried to get warm under a tree and, you know, got hypothermia and died, which can happen in midsummer or cold winter. You know, it's, I'd say bad decision-making, maybe an injury, and I'd say that's the major reason for failure.
For those that are going out backcountry skiing, yeah, or backcountry snowboarding, yeah, or snowshoeing, what advice would you have for them so they make sure that you don't have to go find them?
I'd say go with don't go by yourself. Make your decisions ahead of time as to what you're going to do. I know some of the things that they teach in avalanche courses is that the group mentality gets excited about skiing a certain area when it's dangerous and people don't want to say, no, no, I think this is a bad idea. You have to plan for so that anybody can say, no, let's not go. And that's important to make good decisions ahead of time, because I know that when I go out backcountry skiing, that if I'm at the top of a beautiful field of powder that's steep and impossible, as any steep area is a possible avalanche terrain, I get more brave when I'm right there than the night before when I'm thinking, you know, the avalanche game is kind of like Russian roulette. There are times where there are one bullet and six chambers, or there's times when there's one bullet and 1,000 chambers. You know, you manage your risk, but it's never gone until the snowpack is totally consolidated. So I would say just be cautious and use your head and be with a good group of people that you trust. And I'd say that's the best thing.
That was West Elk Mountain Rescue President Phil Volkhausen. You've been listening to Local Motion on KVNF. I'm Jake Ryan. Stay tuned for As the Worm Turns, coming up next.